Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 54, recorded February 14th, 2011. In Control with Crestron. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheater.com. This week's guest geeks are Fred Bargetzi, the Vice President of Technology at Crestron, and Josh Steen, Director of Product Management, both at Crestron Electronics. Hey, Fred and Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
You, Scott? Good to see you.
Yeah, there's Josh, there's Josh, and Fred is right there, both in a lovely area of Crestron. Is that the Experience Center there?
It is indeed.
You guys have a whole training facility, I believe, there on the East Coast where dealers and others can come and learn about Crestron products and actually put their hands on them, right?
That's right. We're actually in our Experience Center, but we actually have this replicated in 13 offices around the country and then another 20 or so around the world.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's very cool. We're going to get into a lot of what Crestron does, starting with a bit of history. Crestron started over 40 years ago, I think, as a company making slide projector controllers.
Yeah, we actually have some humble roots started by a gentleman named George Feldstein. He's still our president and CEO. And he started out making some doing contract manufacturing and engineering, went into slide projector controls, and it kind of took off from there into the world of AV.
Yeah. You told me offline that you also were an early player in the ATM machine business.
Yeah, we actually made some of the first Citibank deposit machines, which was really the precursor to the automatic teller devices that you see today. Wow. And on top of that, we even made things as esoteric as digital jewelry scales, some of the first.
Whoa, that's pretty cool.
Yep.
Are you still into any of that business, or is it now strictly audio video?
No, it's definitely matured, and we have our hands full today making all we can for AV and environmental control and all sorts of other good stuff.
Great. Well, we're going to get way into audio video control and distribution, and I want to make sure everybody logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv or the live video stream at live.twit.tv knows that they can post questions for Fred and Josh, and I'll pass on as many as I can as we go along. So when did Crestron get involved with audio video content and distribution?
I'm looking at Josh here. I've been here for 20 years. Josh has been here for 10. And I think it was actually in the late 90s, really, if you want to talk about residential home control. And that's really when we started to get into audio distribution, when it became big, probably 96, 98 or so.
Right, yeah, Josh? Somewhere around there.
But you'd been doing control, like home automation and control type things before that, right?
Absolutely. Although, when I started back in 1990, control was really limited to the boardroom. There were a few home installations that were going on back then. As a matter of fact, I remember one of the first jobs that I was on was for Norman Lear, the producer of All in the Family. Yeah, at his house.
Oh, wow.
This was actually back in 1990, so I guess we have been doing it for some time. And it was a lot less sophisticated back in those days. We were actually running the big 35-millimeter film projectors, doing some basic lighting and things like that. And that was really probably some of the early starts of home automation. But it was definitely the super wealthy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I have to say that Crestron still sort of has the reputation for being for the wealthy. That is, the products that you offer and the systems that you provide are relatively expensive. Is that still true? I'm sure it must be still true, but have you gone down market at all?
Well, historically, that definitely, there is some truth to that. The systems are very complicated and have been very complicated, especially many years ago. But we've seen that dynamic change quite a bit recently, especially over the last year or two, where we've actually introduced whole new product lines that are dedicated to people that are a little more budget conscious, but they still want similar performance. For instance, we have a Prodigy line of products that is geared toward control, audio distribution, theater systems for that more budget-minded individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about a little bit more detail about that system a little bit later. But I wanted to ask if any of your products are, shall I say, DIY, or does it really require an installer to put it together? As you mentioned, it's a very complex kind of system. So I would imagine that in most cases anyway, you'd really want an installer to put it in and set it up and program it and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Today, we're still geared towards the value-added integrator or the installer, just because most of the systems that we find are being installed today include lighting, security, and HVAC. And those are things that typical DIYers don't want to get involved with.
Right. Exactly.
High voltage and do-it-yourself doesn't always mix.
Yeah, exactly. I've already got a question in the chat room that anticipates something that I was going to ask anyway. Do you sell equipment that does video over UTP, which I only recently learned means unshielded twisted pair?
Ah, so that's a good question. Actually, for the past 12 years, we've been doing video distribution over unshielded twisted pair. Although up until a few years ago, which the system was very successful, what we were doing was composite S or component video along with SPDIF over UTP. And we probably sold 50,000 plus systems.
Oh, easily. It was extremely popular line of products because it was really the first method to use a single cable to get all those video and audio signals around the house in an analog domain.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Go ahead.
Did it do video, but it also did control. And that's why it was real unique because, once you get the audio and the video out to the display, you actually have to control the display as well. And so that's why the system, I think, was so successful, but it was because it incorporated all the elements that you needed for a truly integrated audio-video distribution system.
Now, did I hear you say that it distributed component video?
It did. Good old-fashioned component video. I know you don't hear about that much these days.
Well, you don't. Even less composite, which you also mentioned. Or was it S-video?
Composite S and component.
Wow. Component normally needs three cables. How did you multiplex those onto a single cable?
The beauty of unshielded twisted pair is it's got four pairs. So three pairs were used for the component signal. And then on the fourth pair, we'd actually send digital audio or SPDIF down to the destination.
Mm. I've got another question in the chat room here right away asking for you to tell the story of your, quote, most Mac Daddy install. I assume that means like the biggest, most massive, most complex.
there's just so many amazing installations that our integrators have done over the years. I mean, I'll name one that's just a little unusual. I remember one of the last jobs that I was when I was working down in our Florida office, and kind of consulting on a design was actually for a large mega yacht. And this boat had, at the time, using that older analog distribution system over UTP, had over 70 zones of video distribution on the boat.
On a boat?
On a boat. So it was a pretty big installation. And the homes, then obviously, if you use that as your benchmark, the homes just go up in scale and grandeur from there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, one of the last homes that I was at up in Canada was a little 60,000 square foot residence.
A little log cabin in the woods.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. I think it took about an hour and a half to walk through at a brisk pace just to go see all the rooms. So, the sky's the limit with most of these things. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And now, of course, though, that was, Josh, you were mentioning this big super yacht being in one of these analog systems. Now, of course, I'm sure you're more focused on digital distribution. How does that differ from the analog systems of the past?
Well, we can both answer to that, but the complexity goes up dramatically. I mean, you start dealing with the digital signals, the bandwidth goes up, you know, exponentially. The complexity because of things like HTTP, the key encryption for content protection, adds additional layers on top of that that make distributing signals out across a home or a mega yacht or whatever whatever the installation is just it's a lot more difficult. But the benefit is great because you have a higher definition signal. Now you're talking about multi-channel audio, multi-channel high definition audio. You're talking about control. You're talking about things like USB for transport of Xbox controllers and things like that. So you can really centralize all of your componentry in a rack room and not have all the clutter in each of the individual rooms around the house.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of bandwidth do these systems require? I mean, it must be pretty immense.
It's pretty nasty. You know, if you look at what composite video was, you know, in comparison to HDMI. I mean, today to do HDMI deep color, which of course, if you're going to do a high-end system, you got to have deep color. You're looking at anywhere from, you know, 50 megahertz from some of the old stuff, right, all the way up to 1.1 gigahertz for uncompressed deep color HDMI. And you know, when you're in the gigahertz range, you're talking about you know, signals that need to be carefully handled, and distributing them over long distances is definitely a challenge. So it really can't be handled lightly. It's not something that can be done typically on traditional cabling. And although technology is evolving tremendously, we started actually development on a product line. We call it digital media about 3.5 years ago. And the concept behind this whole thing was to not only take any analog video source that you might have in your home, but we also, of course, wanted to be able to handle all the digital video sources like DVI or HDMI or maybe even HDSDI, depending upon the installation. And, you know, back when we started this whole thing, our whole concept was, wouldn't it be great if we could just stream everything? It would just make things a heck of a lot easier. You could run your Ethernet network throughout the house and life would be pretty good. But the problem was the technology really just wasn't there at the time. To take in an uncompressed HDMI signal and stream it throughout the house, the cost of the endpoints was tremendous. The horsepower that you needed to do that was significant, and it really just wasn't something that could be accomplished. But fortunately, through some other alternative technology that we had, we were able to introduce this product line and send these high-definition signals uncompressed over shielded twisted pair throughout the house.
Yeah, so you're not using really... I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Josh, please.
So the challenge was really taking that 1.1 gigahertz signal and then fitting it on that that shielded twisted pair that's running at about 250 megahertz. And that's really the technology behind digital media, the magic behind it. And that's what we've achieved and to great success on the product line.
So you're not using the home's already existing local area network. You're actually having to install a separate set of wires to do this, right?
That's correct. The problem with most typical home installations, at least today, is if you look at a cable box or a satellite receiver, is that you don't get to touch the content in its compressed digital format. You're in the compressed digital format, you can certainly stream it. You can get a nice high-definition stream at about 50 megabits per second if you have a dedicated pipeline. But because we can't touch that cable content or the satellite box or the cable TV content, I should say, it's coming out in HDMI, you're looking at full unbridled, uncompressed, high-definition video, which you know, is running at 1.1 gigahertz in deep color. And there's no Ethernet network that I know of today that can handle 1.1 gigahertz bandwidth, because that is, I mean, when you talk about a gigahertz or gigabit Ethernet network, I mean, that doesn't include retransmissions and all the other good stuff that you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
to be able to send 1.1 gigahertz of video down a pipeline, you need some serious cabling and transmission infrastructure.
And nobody wants to sit there and deal with buffering problems and things like that that you can sometimes experience with streaming content. They want to have it like their cable box or their Blu-ray player is plugged directly via an HDMI cable 2 feet away from their display.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. From what you're saying, it sounds to me like wireless would not even be an option in a big Crestron system like this.
You know what? We've evaluated a number of technologies, and we work with all the leading chipset manufacturers today. There is some really good wireless technology that's starting to hit the market. The problem is that it's still relatively limited in distance. The bandwidth is high, even if you certainly if you send it uncompressed, you're still in the gigahertz range. If you compress it, then you're of course going to lose some quality, and that's one of the big untold secrets with wireless technology today is that they don't realize that you're actually compressing it. Not only that, when you compress video and you stream it, you run into a challenge with surround sound processing. So I'll give you a good example. Imagine if you had a cable box going into a surround sound receiver so you can get your full surround sound audio, and then you take the output of that surround sound receiver to a streaming device to go up to your display. The problem is that when you're streaming it, you're going to compress it, you're going to add latency to it, and sometimes it could be 2 to 4 seconds of latency, which I don't know any surround sound processor that can even compensate for that today.
And not only can it not compensate for it, that latency is not a static thing. It's going to be a variable that changes back and forth. And so now you have to have a surround sound processor that's going to vary its lip sync delay based on something that is an unknown.
Right. Oh, so if you go to Comedy Central, which is low definition, the compression is a lot less and it will stream a lot quicker. But then when you go to one of the high definition channels, now it's a lot longer. So you really can't even compensate for that. So for us, we've chosen not to go to wireless. That's just one of the many reasons. Since we're selling through a network of value-added installers, to be able to run some shielded twisted pair really isn't a big deal. And we also provide the option to go with fiber as well.
So that was my next question. I was going to ask you about fiber. Obviously, you got plenty of bandwidth there.
Absolutely. Yeah, fiber is really unlimited. It's becoming a lot easier to terminate. As a matter of fact, in all our training courses, we teach our integrators how to terminate fiber. The cost is not that much more expensive than even running shielded twisted pair. And so we're finding that that's an option that a lot of our folks are choosing.
And early on, there was a lot of hesitance and fear in a lot of the residential industry because many of the integrators hadn't been dealing with fiber all that often. And once we went through and we started teaching in our courses how to terminate fiber, show them the proper tool sets and how everything goes together, we're seeing a great dynamic of people going over to fiber because of the benefits. Like as you said, you have an extreme amount of bandwidth, and now things like distance limitations really do go away. And when you're talking about 60,000 square foot houses, in many cases, that is something to be concerned with.
Are you okay with plastic fiber? Has plastic fiber gotten to the point where it can carry the kind of bandwidth you're looking at, or do you really need glass?
That's a good question. I mean, it really depends on the manufacturer. We've definitely seen some plastic fiber that has come out that has pretty high specifications. We do sell for our digital media solutions, we do sell fiber with the Crestron name on it, which is basically tested and certified to work with those high definition, high bandwidth signals. So we always suggest to utilize that because it's going to ensure your performance, both whether you're using the fiber or the copper solutions.
Mm-hmm. But I will say there are some unique solutions. For example, a lot of people think of fiber running through the walls and all that good stuff. We actually have a very unique solution, which is a fiber extender, which allows you to run HDMI, let's say, from your theater rack up to your display. And the fiber actually looks like a piece of fishing line. So it's transparent. It's not in a jacket, and it's flexible. And the nice thing about that is I can literally run it up a wall, and you'd never see it. So there's a lot of advantages that fiber has today. And as Josh said, the cost has come down. We even sell it pre-terminated to take the fear out of it. And so, we're finding a lot of people choosing the fiber option.
I'm amazed that you can do fiber without a jacket. Don't you get some amount of light loss through it under those conditions?
Now it's the outer portion is treated so that the light waves reflect back, and it's really quite spectacular. It's a really elegant solution.
Yeah, it's been a good solution for integrators because there's especially as things have started to transition over to deep color and the bandwidth has increased so significantly. They may have had an existing installation where they had a traditional HDMI cable between the rack and the projector. All of a sudden, you introduce deep color and the picture's black. The cable wasn't capable of handling the bandwidth, and so now they have a nice solution where they can run this really thin, easy-to-fish piece of fiber, put the transmitter on one end, the receiver on the other end, and they've got they're ensured that they're going to get a good quality signal to the projector.
Now, you guys have mentioned deep color a number of times, and I'd like to, first of all, define what it means for our listeners who might not know, which is that the number of bits used to represent each color, red, green, and blue, is expanded, is increased from 8 to, what's the number now, 24 as a maximum?
12
yep. bits per yep. color, which does require a lot more bandwidth. However, I have a problem with deep color in that there are plenty of displays now that can display deep color, that can accept this new higher resolution color representation, but there's no content that you can get, you can buy in any way. So what's the bit, why are you, deal with that?
Herein lies the problem. If the display is capable of displaying deep color, part of the information that gets sent back and forth on the HDMI cable, the EDID information, basically says, I'm a display and I can support deep color. So what it does is basically everything downstream is going to transmit or transport that in that high, you know, that deep color format, even though the data on the line isn't actually there. The content, as you said, isn't physically there, but it is eating up the bandwidth.
That's interesting. So in other words, it's going to transmit 12 bits, 8 bits of which are going to be the color information, and 4 bits of which are always going to be zero. But what you're saying is that the display sends back this EDID, extended display identification is what that stands for. And so the device says, oh, okay, you can take deep color. I'm going to send you 12 bits per color, even though I only have 8 bits worth of information. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that information, the difference between one display versus the other has been one of the difficulties in distributing HD content throughout a home or a corporation, is that you have different displays that support deep color, non-deep color, different resolutions. And then if you're trying to send one source to multiple displays, that creates a great hardship, because what resolution do you pick?
Not only that, the source doesn't know what to do. It gets confused, and typically what will happen is it'll choose the least common denominator, and all of a sudden now you're going to get a lower-end picture. You might drop down to 720p when you didn't really desire that. So as Josh was saying, is, you know, if I have maybe a display in my kitchen, for example, and you know if you get anything under, 19 inches today or 17 inches, it's all 720p, it may drop down the signal resolution of that beautiful Blu-ray player that you really wanted to also see in your theater in the spectacular high definition, and now you just don't get it. And so HDMI has presented a ton of different challenges because there is a lot of data exchange between the sources and the displays. And right now, the typical user is not aware of any of this. And it was really designed to be intelligent. But the problem is when you put it into the system level, it really becomes the opposite of that.
So how does Crestron deal with this problem of a 17-inch TV in the kitchen and a big screen in the home theater, and you're distributing the same signal to both? Can you, in fact, get around this problem?
Yeah, we actually have a number of different ways that we can get around the problem. One of the first things that we built into our digital media distribution solution was kind of a manager of all these EDID signals. So basically when the integrator goes and commissions the system, part of that is going to go up and define under what cases, I'm going to drop down to 720p, or maybe I'm always going to maintain the 1080p signal. So that's one of the things that they can do through our digital media solution and the software that goes along with it. Alternatively, we can insert things like a high definition scaler at the end of the line, that even if I send a 1080p signal down to that 19-inch display, it can actually bring it down to a 720p signal and maintain that 1080p integrity through the rest of the system. So there's a number of different ways that the solution will simplify this very complex scenario of multiple resolutions and deep color and what have you, because in the end, that end user does not want to have to worry about, you know, can I send that signal to this display? They want to be able to do whatever they want to do when they want to do it.
Sure. I've got a question in the chat room, a couple actually, and the one I want to start with here is there's somebody here who says he's actually thinking about putting a Prodigy system into his house. So can you talk a little bit more about that particular system and what it can and can't do?
Sure. So Prodigy was really designed to allow you to start up with Crestron, maybe from a simple home theater control in a family room, or maybe even a dedicated room to do typical device control. So control of your surround sound processor, DVD player, Blu-ray, amplifiers, whatever it might be, but then allow you to expand out into your home as you see your system growing. So part of the Prodigy line not only includes basic system control, but it also includes retrofit wireless lighting, thermostats, audio distribution, and in the next 90 days or so, we're going to have a version of our digital media product line, which allows you to get HDMI distribution throughout the home as well.
Within the Prodigy, within the lower cost Prodigy line, is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And you know, and one of the nice things today as technology advances is that there are so many consumer devices now which allow you to get into a system like this at a much more economical price. Just a few years ago, you'd have to buy Crestron touch panels and dedicated interfaces. Today, with all the devices out there like iPads and Android devices and the software solutions that we have, it allows you to take advantage of the best of both worlds. So you can use some of our dedicated touch panels maybe on the wall or some handheld remotes in your theater or in your bedroom. But then for some other various places throughout the home, now you can take advantage of the iPad, whether it's within the home or maybe even something like an iPhone or an Android phone as you're out mobile and on the road.
Well, that certainly anticipates the next chat room question from Evolve Home Media, who wants to know about iPad and iPhone type controllers, and it brings me to the part of my talking points that I wanted to talk about, which were various user interface options. You mentioned iPhone, iPad, Android, browsers. I think we have a picture of the iPad, a couple of pictures actually of the iPad in a couple of different configurations here. So how long have you been working on that, and how does that help integrate the entire system and experience?
Well, we actually started making network-based solutions back in 1997. Our first installation was actually a commercial installation, but it was the Cisco Home. And Cisco way back then was promoting the fact that you can network your home, and we were doing control for it. And we had something called eControl, which allowed you on your web browser to launch your web browser and basically take control of your home and emulate one of our touch panels. And that has grown over the years as devices have progressed. And you know, today it's commonplace. Every system that we ship has a web server built into it so that you can have its own built-in UI. And what we've done today is we've taken a standard UI to leverage the power of an iPhone or an iPad, and we've also made that cross-platform along with the Android operating system. We have some partners out there who really capitalize on this, a company called R2W out there, there are just some amazing solutions now to leverage the power of some of this technology.
We saw there a moment ago a picture of the iPad, one of the iPad apps. I wanted to just make sure we didn't gloss over that entirely. There it is. What are we looking at here?
Well, exactly. This is an example of, you know, just one of the variations of interface possibilities that you have. As you look at a home or a home theater today, there's just a myriad of different types of interfaces that you may want to use, and we need to make those available to the end user. You know, for instance, if you're sitting down, you're watching television. Many times, you don't want to be looking at an illuminated screen. You just want to be pressing hard tactile buttons on a remote control. And so we have to make remote controls that allow me to sit there and channel surf without having to look at a touch panel or something along those lines.
This is exactly my point about remotes. Often is I very much prefer hard button remotes over touchscreen remotes for that exact reason. And so I think here's a picture of an iPad piece of hardware, a little thing. Describe this to us that gives us this.
Yeah, so this is a perfect example. The iPad, is a very clean looking display. It's a touch panel display, and there's a lot of benefits behind that touch panel. It's why we make touch panels today, because you can sort through lists and metadata and things along those lines. But as you were referring to, sometimes you just want some hard buttons for your most common features, like volume up, volume down, you know, guide left, right, up, down, enter, those type of things. And so what we did is we actually took the iPad and we put basically like a case over the top of this product and added those hard buttons right on. So those buttons then communicate through the iPad back out through the wireless network and control your system. So now you get the best of both worlds. You get that nice iPad user display and the hard buttons that you want when you're just trying to surf through the channels.
Do you have anything like that either currently or in the works for an iPhone? Because the iPad is pretty big to be, you know, sitting on your lap or on your couch or something. An iPhone would seem to me to be a little more more like a regular remote control.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at an iPhone today, again, it's pretty powerful. But, you know, if you're going to snap it into one of these remotes, you know, I know I personally wouldn't be leaving my iPhone at home when I go to work for the kids to control the TV. So, So really on that side of things, I think that we have a really nice selection of dedicated, you know, simple push button remotes to some very nice LCD displayed remotes that are price competitive with what it would take to take an iPhone and then snap on, you know, an accoutrement to give you the hard button. So I think we have some good selections for that today.
Right. I got another question in the chat room. Any plans for distributed 4K? Never satisfied. No one's ever satisfied.
Yes, 4K. That's definitely true.
Ultra HD.
We promise to continue to evolve the digital media product line to keep up with technology and the various different resolutions and things like 3D, which were brought online recently. So there's always going to be the next new thing, and that's really what we pride ourselves here at Crestron, is we sink so much of our time, energy, and Mr. Feldstein is great because he sinks invests a lot of money back into the company for R&D, and we will continue to develop digital media and other product lines to take advantage of these new higher resolutions in both video or audio or whatever the next big thing is.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the digital media system, or DM, I guess you abbreviate it. And there's another piece of it that we haven't talked about yet that I want to make sure we do, which is called Sonnex. Can you describe how that interfaces with the DM system?
Yeah, actually, it's actually a separate product line, but it's designed to complement it. You know, the concept behind DM or digital media was to take all your video sources, including HDMI, and I think probably most folks listening on here know that HDMI includes audio now, multi-channel audio, and distribute that throughout the home. But you know, in many homes, you might have a dedicated theater, but let's take, for example, a kitchen. You know, in a kitchen, I'd like to have a nice display, and I'd like to have what we call, you know, what we refer to as traditional audio distribution, where I might have some nice ceilings in my speaker and I can watch this really nice high definition display, but I'd also like to have some better audio than what would come out normally the sides of the speakers that are included with the display. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to do audio distribution in conjunction with video distribution, this is where the Sonnex line comes into play. So the concept is that if you run your video source into our digital media product line, it will take in uncompressed high definition HDMI video along with multi-channel audio. And each one of our input cards in the digital media switcher has a digital signal processor or a surround sound processor. And here's where it gets interesting. We allow you to take that HDMI signal and send it out to your home theater and to the surround sound processor in the home theater to get your 7.1 audio. But because the HDMI signal goes into this surround sound processor card, we downmix it to 2-channel, and then we pass it along to what we call our Sonnex system. And our Sonnex system is a audio distribution system that takes in up to 24 sources, analog and some digital, and then sends it out. In this particular unit you're looking at right here, it sends it out to 8 zones or 8 different rooms at 140 watts per channel per room.
You send out amplified audio so that the speakers at the end don't need an amplifier at the local end.
Exactly. So the Sonics solution takes in stereo analog audio, SPDIF digital audio, where the digital media product takes in, say, HDMI or any type of video, multi-channel audio, downmixes it, sends it into the Sonic system. The Sonic system then distributes it as an amplified signal through traditional speaker wires out to your in-ceiling, your in-walls, floor-standing speakers, whatever you might have. That way, you can have zones of video that don't necessarily require a surround sound receiver, a theater product like that, that I can have nice, high-quality two-zone or stereo audio along with that high-definition display. And then I'll have theater zones, media room zones that will be taken care of completely by digital media, where I'll have the high-definition video signal and the 7.1 or whatever, 5.1 surround sound audio that goes along with it. So you really get the best of both worlds, since digital media will down-mix automatically while maintaining the 7.1 signal for other rooms.
Now, I'm curious about sending speaker-level signals from a central location where the Sonics box might be versus sending line level or digital to a remote local amp near the speakers. I've always thought that sending speaker level over long distances was often not a good idea.
Well, that's a good point, is that and then one of the things that's unique about the Sonics product is that each 8-zone module really distributes the audio through speaker level to the local rooms near that product. And then we have our Sonics bus, which utilizes shielded twisted pair, Cat6 type wiring. Mm-hmm. And I can go and remotely put zones out on that Sonics bus network. So I can put another 8 zones of amplified audio distribution, maybe in a different wing of the house or a different floor of the house, so that each of my speaker line runs is maintained fairly locally, so I don't have those losses that you're probably referring to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, it sounds like 8 zones, of course, that would be a little too small for Crestron land. So Sonics actually gives you 8 outputs, which gets you up to 72 zones. And you can distribute that throughout the house if you're going out to a pool house or something else. We can even extend that by fiber and go out to one of these remote receiver units and come back in and then go amplified to the speakers locally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In one of these 60,000 square foot homes, I'm sure that's what you would do there, huh?
It's pretty standard, really. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned surround sound processors and the main theater room, and I just wanted to touch on that a little bit, because while Crestron has mostly been involved in audio-video distribution and control, recently you guys got involved with preamp processors and power amps for the home theater, and also media source devices as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, it's interesting. Before we got online here, I thought you might ask how long we've been making surround sound processors for. So I had to go back and take a look. We've actually been shipping surround processors since 2003. And they were part of that Composite-S component PVID video solution that we talked about right at the beginning of this program. Mm-hmm. You know, when we distribute SPDIF audio and component video to a room, we needed some sort of hardware or appliance-grade device to bring it back into multi-channel audio to go to an amplifier and then give the integrator full control. So we shipped thousands of surround sound processors over the years. And then back in 2007, probably 3 or 4 years ago, we introduced a product line called Adagio, where we had an integrated surround sound processor, multi-channel audio distribution system, plus control system bundled into one unit. And we sold many thousands of those units as well. So surround sound processing and DSP is not something that's new to us. As a matter of fact, we've been doing it in our commercial product line for many, many years for the boardroom and conference rooms. But I think the product that you're referring to is something that we call ProSice. And this was, you know, this was really our entry into the high-end surround sound processing, kind of the esoteric world of you know, bringing you that premium quality sound. And so Josh can add a little bit more to this side of things.
Yeah, so ProSice is really made up of two primary components. First, the surround sound preamplifier, and then secondarily, one of two amplifier choices. We have a seven-channel amplifier. We actually have two seven-channel amplifiers. One is 400 watts a channel into 8 ohms, 700 watts a channel into 4 ohms, and the other one is 250 into 8, and then I forget the exact number, into 4 ohms. Still quite significant. And then the preamp product is a little bit unique. You know, really the goal of any high-end audio system is to be able to take in the signal from whatever source it is, bring it in, and today pretty much everything gets digitized, so you have to have the best A to Ds that are on the market today, the best DACs that are on the market today. Your signal-to-noise ratio has to be through the roof. Ours is greater than 130 dB through the DACs. So it really has to be a system that can pass the signal from one point to the other out to the amplifier as absolutely as cleanly as possible. And that's what we really strove to do in this ProSize line. We do that by bringing it in. We interconnect the preamp and the amplifier through high-quality balanced signaling types. And you know, we support pretty much every type of input on that preamp that you're going to want. You're going to have your analog audio, both balanced and unbalanced, SPDIF, TOS, even have AES, EBU, and your HDMI, which is going to get you all your high-definition audio signals from things like Blu-ray players and satellite receivers and whatnot. And from there, you know, audio really is very personal, and that's where this product, it really shines, is we have the ability within that audio product to go in and have it automatically EQ to your room environment. If you're an audiophile and you have the tool set to do so, you can go in and utilize graphic and parametric EQs to tweak this to your personal taste. And even things that are a little more esoteric, like it's actually a 7.3 processor, so we have multiple subwoofer outputs that you can distribute subwoofers around the room that is going to compensate for room anomalies like room mode cancellations and things along those lines. So
now, why did you choose three subs instead of four, for example, or two?
Well, it's really a number of different variables. You know, the more subs that you put in the room, the more room modes that you're physically going to excite, and the less chance you're going to have high peaks or nulls somewhere in the space. So in this particular scenario, we looked at having, you know, subs in the front, subs in the back, subs, you know, somewhere in the center position as a possibility. Mm-hmm. One of the unique things that we do that many other manufacturers haven't done is we actually have separate EQs, delays, level adjustments for every single one of those subwoofer outputs. So the goal is really to make it seem like it's one subwoofer in that room space, even though that you have multiples that are distributed around the room.
Right. I'm sure you guys must be familiar with Floyd Toole's work on subwoofer placement and how multiple subs placed properly can, in fact, minimize room modes and such.
Exactly. That's one of the reasons and rationales behind that process. You know, but in the end, you can only do so much in the DSP, and we try to do as much there as possible. But as you know, if you don't look at the room first and treat the room and do things like that, a lot of it is all for naught.
Exactly right. In fact, I always try to get the room and the speaker placement as good as it can be before starting to apply DSP, which means that minimizes the actual use of DSP, which I think is, in my opinion, is the best approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you're really using the DSP more for your personal taste. Mm-hmm. More than anything, you know, everybody's got, you know, you look at things like graphic EQs and you walk into somebody's, you know, home many years ago when you saw graphic EQs that were still sliders. And you walk into one room and somebody really took the time to flatten the response out, and you can pretty much look at it and tell that, and then you walk into 90% of the other rooms and you had the smiley face.
Right. So
it really is, it is personal. You still have people out there that are telling you that you know, you can tell the difference between a $150 speaker cable and a $1,000 speaker cable. So
right.
You know,
do you dispute that?
I'm pretty sure that I do. You have $500,000 worth of audio test equipment that can't hear the difference, but somehow the human ear can.
This is a great debate that I actually love to get into with as many people as I can, because there as many people as there are with an opinion, there are different opinions about it.
Absolutely.
Before we run out of time, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you. I believe Crestron recently introduced a media server. Is that ADMS?
That's right. Yep. We introduced the digital media server, and the concept behind this whole thing really came out of the frustration in the home, which was that there were so many sources today for media that it was really hard to collect them together. And so, and I'll give you an example. I was actually home with my daughter a few years ago, and she wanted to watch Harry Potter. And of course, I had a multi-disc DVD changer at the time. I had on-demand cable. I even had a box called a Vudu box at the time. And
Vudu so is still here, obviously.
Yeah, Vudu's here. They just don't make it as a separate box. And but I had the separate box, one of the early ones. And, you know, she came to me and asked me if she could watch Harry Potter. And I thought, of course, no problem. And 15 minutes later, I found myself searching through my my DVD library, the on-demand, even through the Vudu. And, you know, she kind of looked at me, you know, all of 10 years old with a sense of frustration. And said, see you later. I'm going to do something fun. And I sat there saying, my gosh, I couldn't even find this media. So the concept behind our media server was that we wanted to be able to bring these disparate forms of media together, allow you an easy search engine to go out and look at some of the different online content providers, plus your local DVD and Blu-ray library, and even anything that you have on your network attached storage drive, and bring that together at your fingertips and allow you to see it in the family room or the theater. And so that's what we've done.
So is this a computer-based system? It's like a Windows computer that's putting this all together, or what's the infrastructure there?
It is, but it's an appliance-grade PC. We spent a lot of time fabricating the hardware on there to, you know, it's not just your standard PC shoved inside of an enclosure. We also work directly with Microsoft for a long time to lock down the system. And, you know, we went with a Microsoft-based system because of all the encryption and DRM capabilities that we needed to be able to handle. So it's been a very good success for us, but it continues to progress. It's one of those products where once you release it, you know, you still have to have a team of engineers to continue to add on features, take in and ingest new content. And the nice thing about it is that we can push this content out to our customers who purchase the unit.
Now, does it have a Blu-ray player integrated into it, or does it access an outboard Blu-ray player? How do you get Blu-ray content, for example? Can you import Blu-ray content onto a hard disk, which I would think probably not legally anyway?
Well, so the answer is yes, yes, and yes. We do a model that has an internal Blu-ray player. We also have a 200 disk, and now we actually have a 400 disk Blu-ray changer that complements the system, and you can add up to four 400 disk Blu-ray changers onto the system. And then if some people find a way to get content onto a hard drive, we can certainly play that back. We have all the provisions inside the box, but we don't provide them with the opportunity to do that.
To rip the Blu-rays onto a hard drive, huh?
That's right. There's certain legal challenges with that.
Right. Exactly. Well, in the last couple of minutes, I there's one other area I wanted to touch on. It gets back to the area of control. And I know that Crestron's been long involved in RS-232 control, which is typical in larger, more extensive, more expensive type of systems. Do you also use infrared, radio frequency, Bluetooth? Are all of these options with Crestron systems?
Again, there, the answer is yes, yes, and yes. You know, we've made our living on taking disparate types of devices and linking them together no matter how they're controlled. So infrared and RS-232, you know, probably are still the most popular forms of control. However, we're seeing more and more devices are Ethernet-based or TCP/IP-based control. So, for example, that Vudu box that I talked about even a few years ago, it wasn't even introduced with any infrared control. It was strictly a proprietary RF control or Ethernet-based control. So we have mastered certainly network-based control, and we're seeing more and more devices go that way. But then as far as other devices coming out, you know, we're starting to see some other technologies as far as wireless become popular. Yeah. Probably 4 or 5 years ago, we introduced, and we were one of the leaders in development for what's called Zigbee today. and that's mesh network technology. And so we have a lot of products that ship. We've shipped hundreds of thousands of lighting products that are mesh network based. We actually call it Infinet, now Infinet EX, we're in our second generation.
And mesh, I'm sorry, define mesh network. I don't remember what that stands for.
A mesh network is a concept where every device, let's say a light switch inside of a wall, is not only able to receive control signals by RF, but it's able to transmit back its status over RF, and incorporated into that is a repeater. So every one of these devices that go in your home form a network, and the more devices you have in the home, actually the better network coverage that you get. So the nice thing about this technology is you can put in light switches, you can put in thermostats, and then we also make handheld remote controls, which now instead of having to install a Wi-Fi network throughout your home and make sure that you have the proper coverage, the more of these devices you install, the better your network is, and it really makes for a really nice network.
Ah, understood. And that, of course, also brings us to the fact that your systems can not only control audio-video distribution, but lighting, the climate system, security systems, all that kind of stuff. And I think what you're saying basically is if you have these mesh network devices, light switches and so on throughout your house, it's essentially giving you even overall coverage throughout your house, wherever these things are.
That's right. It's really nice. And, you know, I will tell you, we've been doing, as I said, Josh and I have been doing home control for forever. And I will say, even above audio and video, the you know, it's a lifestyle thing. If you go into a home, even a 3,000 or 4,000 square foot home, if you count the number of light switches that you have, and if you have kids, I think we all know about the fact that you go to sleep at night and you got to walk around the house and turn the lights off. You know, just the fact to have a lighting system in the home, and if you look at our Prodigy line, the prices have come down significantly, makes it much more affordable, gives you energy savings, and you know what? It's a peace of mind. I mean, I know I travel a fair amount, and my wife really enjoys the fact that if she hears a noise downstairs, she presses one button and all the lights go on. It certainly would scare the heck out of me if I was breaking into somebody's house. So that and thermostat control, you know, I really feel like those are some of the fundamentals of where everything is heading today, you know, of what people just expect today with the electronic lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing our best to make these things a lot more affordable, to allow people to start out with some environmental control. And then, you know what, if you want to add some AV to it, heck, go for it. We have that too.
Fantastic. Well, Fred and Josh, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. It's been very informative, and I have sure enjoyed myself.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate having us.
It was a pleasure.
You bet. You can get all the scoop on Crestron products of all the types we've been talking about at Crestron.com. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Twit is off next week for President's Day, but we'll be back in 2 weeks when my guest geek is scheduled to be J.J. Johnston, chief scientist at DTS, to talk all about audio formats, which he's been working on for many, many years. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I sure hope you'll join me. Until then, geek out.